Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another edition of the Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My guest today is author Linda Frank, who has three books in print in her Annie Tillery mystery series. Linda, it is great to talk to you again.
Hi, Simon. It's great to talk to you as well.
I know I've asked you this before, but for the benefit of new listeners, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. I was born in New York City, in Queens, which is on Long Island. Long Island is that little island that kind of sticks out from New York into the ocean. I've never left Long Island. I mean, I've never lived anywhere else. I obviously left it for travel and whatnot. So I'm very familiar with New York and with Long Island, and there are many fascinating places here. I ended up, as a career choice, being a science teacher. And my teaching of science led me into teaching forensic science. As a kid, I loved Nancy Drew, and so I took my love of Nancy Drew and all kinds of mysteries, because science is a mystery, really, or it solves mysteries, and my knowledge of forensic science, and I decided that I would create a mystery series for young adults. And so after having a full career in science, in teaching science, I moved on to becoming an author, and now I'm writing and I'm attempting to market these wonderful books.
A question for you. Where does your interest in forensics come from?
Well, I think it's just a matter of loving mysteries. I like all kinds of mysteries. They don't have to be crimes. I like the ancient mysteries. Is the Shroud of Turin really the impression of Christ's face? Is a painting in a museum actually a work of Rembrandt, or is it one of his students? What about archaeological digs, the things they find there? All kinds of mysteries just fascinate me, and I think it's that curiosity that led me to go into science in general. And then I just have this specific love of mysteries. Give me a mystery to solve or read, and I really enjoy that.
Now, I'm not sure that we're going to get into the Shroud of Turin.
No, good.
right, but I'm pretty certain we're going to get into the murky world of art and archaeology, but we'll get to that in just a moment. The last time we spoke, it was about your third book, The Secrets in the Fairy Chimneys. I liked it so much that I decided I needed to read the first two. While you are correct that the books do stand alone, I personally would encourage people to read them in order. I'd like your thoughts on that subject.
Well, I wrote them to stand alone because I know how I buy books. I'll see something that's very interesting to me, and I'll buy it regardless of where it stands on the list of books that authors have written. And then if I like the book, I'll go back and read other books. So I know that people do that because I do it. But by the same token, the best way to read these is in order, simply because Annie grows. Annie changes through the books. You know, she's a little bit older in each one of the books, and her relationship with her boyfriend progresses through the books. So, yes, I definitely would encourage people to read them in order, but it is not necessary.
Let's start with book one, the Madonna Ghost. Would you care to set the scene for us?
Sure. Annie, who lives with her aunt, she doesn't live with either parent because her mother has an alcohol and drug abuse problem, and she's in and out of rehab, so it's difficult for Annie to live with her. And her father works for the State Department, so he's never home. So she lives with her aunt. Her aunt is a New York City police detective. I had to give Annie a connection into the world of crime, because that just makes things more interesting, and it makes it easier for her to get involved with various mysteries or crimes. She goes with her aunt to Fire Island. Fire Island is a sandbar off the coast of Long Island, much like the famous Jersey Shore, which was made famous by Hurricane Sandy. And Fire Island has been inhabited for hundreds of years. It has a rich history. But right now, in present day, it is no longer important for fishing or shipwrecks or any of the rest of it. It's a resort place. So she goes on vacation. The people that she and her aunt are staying with, the man has a nephew. Annie falls in love with him. His name is Ty Egan. And together they decide to consult a local historian about a ghost. And her boyfriend, Ty, claims to have seen the ghost, and the historian absolutely says that the ghost is it's a real apparition, it's not a hoax. So what they do is they decide to investigate the ghost, both historically and by stalking the beach at night to see if she shows up. And while they're doing this, her aunt has to go back to the city to work on a case, and she disappears. She drops off the radar. And so Annie, of course, is very upset. She doesn't know where her aunt is. And the investigation of the ghost proceeds. And what we find out is that the ghost is really hiding a dastardly plot that is about to develop. And that's all I can tell you.
I really liked it. You know, I was reading the book, and the first thing that came to my mind was, it has to be drugs, but it's not.
Yeah. And if you knew Fire Island, you would say it has to be drugs, because Fire Island has a history from way back piracy during Revolutionary War times to bootlegging during the Prohibition, and now drug running.
Right.
You know, every coastal place is like that.
Yes, indeed. I lived for many years in San Diego, so I know all about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where did the idea for Madonna's ghost come from?
Okay, I researched the history of Fire Island pretty vigorously when I was writing the book, and I also was a volunteer at the Fire Island Lighthouse. The Fire Island Lighthouse was commissioned by George Washington, and it was going to be knocked down. And actually, a group of very wealthy business people and famous people based in New York and who have summer homes on Fire Island decided to start an organization to save the lighthouse. And they did. And the lighthouse has become a big attraction for Long Islanders and many other people. So anyway, I volunteered there. They have three programs for school kids when they come. One of them is to do a nature walk, because it is a specific type of an environment or biome. The other part is to climb to the top of the lighthouse, and the lighthouse is 189 steps tall. And then the third part is to investigate how the United States Life Saving Service operated when it did. The U.S. Life Saving Service is the precursor to the Coast Guard, and they have stations all along the coast, not just Fire Island, but all along the coast, where they would look out for ships that were in trouble and then try to rescue not the ship so much, but the survivors. And this investigation into that aspect really caught my attention, especially some of the pictures of the survivors being brought back on a breeches buoy to shore. And I thought in terms of the history of Fire Island and New York City, where men would come from other countries, establish themselves in this country, and then they would send for their wives and their children. And besides that history, we also have this history of hurricanes. So I put it all together, and I had the ship come with the wife and the child in a hurricane. It broke up on shore, and in order to save their children, the women would lash the children to their bodies, and they would try to swim to shore. And this one woman, her child dies. She is mortally wounded, but she keeps trying to get somebody to revive the child. And so after she dies and the whole thing blows over, people begin to see her racing up and down the beach looking for somebody to save her child. So I put a lot of pieces of Fire Island history together, and I made what I think is a very poignant ghost. She's not a threatening ghost. She's very sad and poignant.
Oh, indeed she is. Now, is she fictitious, or does she match something?
No, as far as I know, and I do know some people who do ghost hunting. You know, they follow up on ghost stories. They record the ghosts either visually or auditorily. So I know these people, and as far as I know, she is fictitious.
Okay. By the way, it is a great book.
Thank you.
I know that you aim at the young adult audience. I'm in the OA category, old adult.
Join the crowd. I know. Yeah.
But I really enjoyed it. So let's move on to book two, which I have to admit is probably my favorite, Girl with Pencil Drawing. In my opinion, you can call me out on it, but I view it as cut from a different cloth. Maybe it's the subject matter. Would you care to share the plot outline?
Okay, the plot outline is that Annie is interested. My main character's name is Annie Tillery. And Annie is very interested in art. She likes to draw and paint, and she thinks she has a little bit of talent. So she enters the contest at her school, and she wins a series of art lessons at a gallery in Soho. Soho is the arty part of Manhattan. And when she goes to take the lessons, she comes upon an argument that's going on between her instructor and the director of the gallery. And it's a pretty violent argument. I mean, it borders on becoming very physical. So she interrupts by knocking on the door and saying, "By the way, where are my art lessons?" And, of course, she stops the violence from occurring, and she proceeds to the studio, and the art lesson goes on, and the instructor comes over to her and says, "Would you help me leave this building? Would you leave with me? Because I'm afraid that he's going to hurt me." And, of course, Annie has this little bit of a John Wayne complex, I would say, and she likes to be the hero and help people, and she says yes. So what happens is they do escape. She wants her instructor, whose name is Francesca, she wants her to come back and meet her aunt in the apartment, but Francesca says, "No, I have to settle my business with the art director." And so what happens is the art director is murdered, and Annie and her aunt Jill get a phone call from the police department saying that she's a suspect in the murder of the director of the gallery. And, of course, Annie believes in her because she's young and she's impressionable and very enthusiastic, and she wants her aunt to help her clear Francesca's name. And so that's what she does. And in the process of doing this, they uncovered that the director of the art gallery was involved in a ring of art forgers and art thieves. Actually, that was the pressure he had with the instructor. He was having the instructor make copies of artworks and telling her that he was selling them as, you know, office candy for wall candy for offices. And what he was doing was he was having her really paint obscure works and selling them on the market as the real thing. And when she found that out, she got into a big argument. She said, "I don't want any part of this." And that was the basis of the argument. So they uncover this idea that there is art forgery, and it all revolves around the owner of the gallery. The owner is not the director. She's a woman from Germany. And everything really kind of goes back to this brownstone in Brooklyn where the owner of the gallery lives. And more than this, I don't really want to tell you because it kind of spoils the story, but I will say that the backstory in this book is about the same story that you would find in Monuments Men, either the book or the movie, about what happened with all of the art that was confiscated during World War II by the Nazis. So,
indeed.
It's interesting.
Hmm? Yeah, I picked up on that right away. Now,
yeah.
The Madonna ghost had boyfriend Ty playing a very major role. And your latest release, The Secrets in the Fairy Chimneys, also has Ty as a major player. But he hardly gets a mention in Girl with Pencil Drawing. I have a suspicious mind. Maybe I should have followed you into forensics. I have two theories. First off, he didn't fit the plot well. And second, you were testing the waters, taking Annie in a slightly different direction. How would you respond to that?
Well, both of your theories are partially correct. He didn't fit the plot. He could have. I could have had him visiting Annie on break, and perhaps it would have made a more exciting book if I had had him there and he would have been involved. But I really wanted to take Annie on her own. I wanted Annie to be separated from the romance for a while. In The Madonna Ghost, the romance that develops between Annie and Ty is really an integral part of the book. It's a very sweet romance, and it's just a sweet book that way. But in Girl with Pencil Drawing, I wanted her to stand on her own two feet without the distraction of romance, and I wanted her to really get into this, the business of her learning art and the business of her helping her friend and solving this mystery. There is a little bit of romance because Francesca has a boyfriend in this one. And so there is that, and she talks about Ty, and she does email Ty, who's working on a project in college, and he helps her to solve one of the clues because of his knowledge of the internet. So he's there, but he's very background. I wanted Annie to be Annie by herself.
I have to say that I was incredibly impressed by your knowledge of art and art forgery. Where does that interest come from?
I think it comes from the fact that I went to Catholic school. And in Catholic school, we learned Latin. And Latin is, as you know, it's a classical language. It deals with antiquities a great deal. And Latin was actually used, you probably know this, but Latin was used well into the 1700s and maybe even 1800s, certainly in medicine and even in British law. Cases that were tried in court in Britain were tried in Latin for a long time. That's why so many of our legal terms are Latin ones. And so there was this fascination with ancient civilizations and then the monks who are, you know, sitting at their little desks and making these illuminated manuscripts and using inks that they made by themselves. And I have the science that I also love to teach was chemistry. So anything that has to do with chemical concoctions usually catches my interest. So it's that combination of exposure during my school years to all of this cultural stuff and the encouragement that we had in school to go visit museums and learn about art pieces, and the fact that I have to tell you, when I was a teenager, if you went out, if you had a boyfriend, or even if you moved in a group of kids, we lived in the city. When we went someplace, we went into the museums. So, you know, it was all this exposure to culture, and on the part that really caught my interest was, first of all, just looking at a painting and wondering how you can do that. How can you make this painting that way, and why are the paints different, and how does it progress? It's a fascinating topic.
Oh, I spent 4 years learning Latin. I hated it at the time. You know, Romanus longus fluvus. You know, the Romans have long spears. But later on, I discovered it was quite useful, particularly with crossword puzzles. But
yes. Yeah. Also, it's I really believe that anyone who is going to teach English should take some Latin, because so much of our language comes from Latin, and it helps you. There's such a logic to Latin. There's a logic to its grammar, and grammar, that's sort of an arcane topic now, but it helps you with your logic process, I think.
Oh, I'm in absolute agreement, but had you asked me this at age 18, I would have said, "You're nuts."
Well, you were normal. I was the queen of the nerds.
There's something that you mentioned about art forgery and what Francesca is doing. Girl with Pencil Drawing is about copies. You are entirely right. You know, punting out a new Mona Lisa probably isn't going to get you very far. But the true forgers don't copy. They tend to create originals just by a different hand.
Yeah, and then they claim that they're long lost works by a particular author. There's several routes that they take, and what I found that was really interesting about stolen art pieces is that they're rarely ever found again. And that knowledge, the knowledge of that fact, was part of what motivated me to write the plot in this book, because what happens is these art pieces end up in people's private collections. And so I'm thinking that, you know, I'd like to see the basement of almost any mansion that I come across, because in the basement, I'm assuming there's a private art collection of stolen art, because there's so much there is so much art that is stolen and never seen again. So it's curious.
Right. And, you know, another aspect of your book is that some of these paintings might have come from the Nazi regime, where they raided and stored, never to be seen again.
Yes. I read the Monuments Men, and in the Monuments Men they claimed that by the time they were done, they had actually raided 1,000 locations where these various art treasures, not all paintings, but art treasures were stored. And that's astounding to me, and that I'm assuming that there's probably others, and I'm sure that when these places were raided, that some of the art treasures that were there were probably, they probably found their way not exactly to where they were supposed to be going to be saved. So I'm thinking that there's a lot of stuff spread all over Europe and Asia and God knows where else, probably here as well. That it's just the nature of human beings to possess these things is also a very big topic of curiosity to me. Why do people have to possess these things? It's not even the money.
Well, a philosophical question for you. Let's say you owned an original, but you couldn't talk about it because it, its provenance probably would get you into trouble. And suddenly a copy turns up at Sotheby's. What would you do?
If I had the original and a copy showed up, I think I wouldn't say a word. If I had a secret art collection and I knew it was the original, and I've been keeping it a secret all these years, it isn't like I'm hanging it on my dining room wall and everyone who comes in, I say, oh, look, I have this original. So if it's secret, I wouldn't say a word because they would discover that I had a secret art collection.
Right. Okay. Let's move on to...
And then the next thing I would do would be to contact the artist who did the fake and see what kind of business I could come up with him or her.
Right. I love the plot. I could see an entire book there.
Yep.
Let's move on to your third book, the latest one. I know we've talked about it before, The Secrets in the Fairy Chimney. This also deals with works of art, although not paintings, but antiquities. Would you care to share a little bit about it?
Sure. Secrets in the Fairy Chimneys takes Annie to Turkey to an archaeological dig. Her boyfriend, Ty, and his best friend, whose name is Cedric Zeeks, are working on their a postdoctoral project. And the archaeological dig they're going to, which is a real place in Turkey, this actually exists, is supposedly the oldest town ever discovered, ever. In other words, it goes back like 9,000 years. And one of the things that they're trying to figure out is what made people give up their hunter-gatherer existence or even their primitive agricultural existence and form a town. That's part of it. But the other part is that Cedric, who is African-American, is very interested in extracting DNA from any of the bones that they find there and comparing it to the DNA in the skeletons that have been discovered in Africa of our earliest ancestors. And he wants to see what kind of a connection there is and also interested in tracing how the people in Africa actually migrated to Turkey, which that was a project done by National Geographic where they took DNA samples from people all over the world to try to figure out how people migrated out of Africa. Where did they go first? Where did they finally end up? And was a really fascinating project. So I incorporated that into the book, but of course what happens is some of the artifacts end up stolen. They pack them at the archaeological dig, and then they send them to the university in Istanbul, Turkey. And In one of the shipments, artifacts go missing. They believe they're stolen. But that's really a cover for a real plot that's going on, which, again, I'm not going to tell you about. But what happens is that the people who are behind this are, of course, again, art of any kind, ancient artifacts. This is all very valuable stuff, worth a lot of money. So the people who are involved in any kind of flim-flam with it, if you will, they do their best to protect it. So, of course, there's danger involved, and a few attempts are made on Annie's life and Ty's life, and Annie is almost kidnapped when she arrives in Istanbul. So the book takes place in Istanbul, which, of course, if you've been to Istanbul or seen any documentaries on it, is one of the most fascinating cities in the world. And I take you into the bazaar, and I take you into the underground water system, and it's really an interesting and beautiful background. And then we go into interior Turkey, and that's where you see the fairy chimneys, which are geological formations in an area of Turkey called Cappadocia. And Cappadocia is a tourist attraction because it is so weird. It is the weirdest place I've ever been. Someone was asking me the other day about setting, and they were asking me, no, about writer's block. And I said the first two books really had no writer's block because I knew the setting so intimately. I knew Fire Island, I knew Long Island, I knew Manhattan and Brooklyn. But I've only visited Turkey once. And so while I was writing the book, I kept having to go back to the pictures and the notes and the guidebook and the language. And so that made it harder, but it also, I think, made me a better writer, made me try to capture the whole mood of being in Istanbul and the excitement of the city and then the differentness, the weirdness, the eeriness of Cappadocia. And in the book, a very special feature of the book for me is there's a pair of twins. They're 12 years old, a boy and a girl. They're the children of the director of the archaeological dig, and they immediately take a big liking to Annie and Ty and Cedric, and they attempt to help them solve the mystery by using a Ouija board to channel Nancy Drew. And this is kind of a thing that goes through the book, and I think it's funny. Every time I read the book, I have to laugh. So if I'm still laughing at my book, it must have some humor. that's Secrets in the Fairy Chimneys.
I enjoyed it a great deal. I have to ask the awkward question. You know, why reintroduce Ty?
Well, because Ty is a very important part of Annie's life. I mean, even in Girl with Pencil Drawing, you know that he's very important to her and that she loves him. They exchange a very sweet email. So I wanted to bring him back. And I also wanted to, again, grow Annie up a little bit. And I wanted her relationship with him to become more serious. Because I have an ulterior motive with this. And in the fourth book, this is what happens with my books, and you've done it as well. I wrote them for young adults, but the adults who read them really like the stories, and many times they've said to me, why didn't you write these as adult books? So one of the reasons I wrote them for young adults is because I think children's literature, which is YA falls under children's literature, is that it lives on. Nancy Drew is like, she's almost 100 years old, or not really, she's maybe 80 or 90 years old. You know, kids' books live on. Adult books, unless they're classics, which these, of course, would never be, you know, you write a bestseller, that would be nice, too, but it's on the bestseller list, and then it's gone unless you write another bestseller, and then people might read the second one. So that was one motive. And the other motive was I didn't have the confidence as a writer to write an adult book. So I just thought, I'll write these stories, and I won't have to make them as long and as complicated. But now I have more confidence. So the next book, I'm really thinking that I might try to pitch the next book as an adult book. And then Annie will be really an adult. I mean, she's already, I won't tell you what happens at the end, but she's, you know, she's getting up there in years. She's going to be an adult soon.
Say it's not so. She's going to be what, 21?
Yeah, she'll be 20 or 21 in the next book. And but that's, you know, I can make it an adult book with a 21-year-old because Ty would be around 25 or 26. And the subject matter also will appeal to adults.
Do you think you're going to lose your YA followers?
I don't know. It's kind of a crapshoot. I also thought about taking the first three books and writing them as adult books, rewriting them, but that's too big a project right now. I'd rather write the fourth book. I really don't know how this is going to be received. I think what I might do with this one is I might attempt to get an agent, someone who will believe in this project, because my ultimate goal, of course, is to make this into a TV series.
Oh, I think that would be fabulous.
Well, that's, you know, my writer's eye, that's how it works. I write because I see these things as like a movie that's unfolding in front of me. I just attended a lecture. The guest speakers were the two men who write the script for Law and Order SVU. And they were basically talking about what it's like to write a script for a television program, and it was very interesting to listen to that. So, and I also love public television, and I notice on public television there's a lot of mystery shows, but they're all the mystery shows are all for adults, and then they have a lot of nice children's shows, but there's nothing for the in-betweens. And I'm thinking I would love to be able to pitch Rebecca Eaton on Mystery on public television and say, why not do a serialized, a group of programs for young adults and show them in the afternoon, the after-school program. I don't know. We'll see. Lots of projects.
Love it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, where can people buy copies of your books?
Well, the books are on Amazon, and they're available in ebook, softcover, hardcover, and digital audio. In fact, Secrets in the Fairy Chimneys was just released in digital audio. So you can go on Amazon and just search either the titles or my writer's name is Linda Maria with an A, Frank. If you Google or search Linda Frank, you're going to get a different author. It's a common name, so it's Linda Maria Frank. And then I have a website, just my name, lindamariafrank.com. And on that website, there are lesson plans based on the first two books for teachers. There are book discussion questions if you want to start a book club or have a book discussion in class. There is a forensics column because I do write little forensics articles, which you can find on my Facebook page, but also on my website. My Facebook page is Official Fans of the Madonna Ghost. And they're also available on Barnes & Noble. For librarians, they're available on Baker & Taylor and Ingram. And I know they're on lots of catalogs, but I'm not familiar with all the catalogs. The easiest place to find them is you either go on my website, which has a direct link to Amazon, and you might find the website interesting, or you can go directly to Amazon.
You took the wind out of my sails. I was about to ask you if you'd ever thought about producing audiobooks, but apparently you already have.
Well, let me tell you about that experience, because it was really very interesting. Again, one of my author friends said, you know, there's a workshop in the city on how to make digital audio. want to come with me? Sure. So I went in and I listened to the little lecture, and really it was so easy. It's ACX. A, C is in cat, X is in zebra, no, xylophone. Can't spell either. And just follow the instructions. And you can either, some people actually have the sound equipment and can do their own recording. I can't and don't want to. People said to me, why didn't you read your books? And I said, because the point of view character is 17 years old and I don't sound like I'm 17. So I was pleased with the woman who did the reading. What happens on the website is you put it out there and people bid on it. Producers. The producer is the person who has the sound equipment, who does the reading. They bid on your project. They say, you know, I'll do it. Now, you can either pay them or you can do this thing called royalty share, which means that you split the royalties. It used to be 50-50, but it's not anymore. I think the author gets more. I don't remember what it is, but I'm locked into the old contract, so I have the 50-50 deal. But so easy. I have several friends who did this, and I know audiobooks, you can produce, not audiobooks, but e-books, you can produce your own e-books if you have the correct software. A lot of this just requires software. So, you can, if you have a good story, and my suggestion, because I self-published, is get a good editor, write your story, and get a really good professional editor, produce a clean manuscript, and then shop around on the internet for the various self-publishing companies. And there are a lot of them now. This is no longer Vanity Press self-publishing. It's moved far beyond that, and it's really an industry of its own. Has its own awards. It's really come a long way.
Oh, it certainly has. I mean, when I first started book reviewing, I would pick up a book. First thing I'd look at is who the publisher was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I go, oh, no. It's self-published. But that's completely changed in the last 10 years. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, but there is nothing wrong with self-publishing. The end product is oftentimes better than what comes out of the random houses of the world.
This is the major complaint because I self-published, and I went to Book Expo this year because my publisher, Archway is a division of Simon & Schuster, they had a little reception for us self-published authors, and we had a good discussion, and I've heard this before, the basic complaint against self-published books is, first of all, the editing, that many times they feel that the editing isn't as clean as it is with traditional publishers, although I have not read a traditionally published book yet that doesn't have one or two errors in it. And I think that's a function of the computer programs. And then the other is the appearance of the book. Now, Secrets in the Fairy Chimneys, the cover of that book is a finalist in a cover contest. So you can't say that the appearance of those books is, not good. And then I picked companies, when I did the self-publishing, I picked companies that adhered to industry standards, that they didn't just take my manuscript and publish it. They critiqued it, and they told me what it needed, and because it was, especially with the Madonna Ghost, it was my first one, I just did everything they said. I took the editorial services, and I think that they produced a nice, clean copy. Now, I republished them because I put illustrations in the book. And my illustrator, whose name is Marianne Savage, I think she's quite talented and definitely does wonderful illustrations for this genre. So, yeah, it's been, the other thing with self-publishing is you own the book. You own every decision, and no one is telling you, you have to do it this way or you have to do it that way. And the hard thing with it is to get it, to do the marketing and to get it out there. So that's been a lot of work, but fun.
Okay, let's talk about marketing. I was thinking about this earlier today. Have you considered putting all three books in a bundle? I know that Christmas seems a long way off, but I think it would make an excellent Christmas present.
Yeah, that's when I sell the books at various events that I attend. And funny that you should say that Christmas is not a long way off. It's not. I just signed up for Christmas fair. I will sell the three books together at a significant discount. And I have, you know, people can't, you know, they can't resist a bargain. And you're right about that. And I think, and this is something I keep meaning to do and just get sidetracked, I want to contact Amazon and ask them how I can do it, because my books are offered in such a way that if you buy, I think, the soft cover and the e-book, they give you the digital audio for free. But I don't really know if it crosses over to the other books. I don't think so. Now, if they offered, if you bought the soft cover of one and the e-book of another, then and they gave you the digital audio of the third, I think that would be better. So I have to investigate that, because that's a really good idea.
Well, what I think I would advocate is a package that includes a sleeve, if you will, you
uh-huh.
know, so that, you know, rather than three individual books, here's the package.
Well, you know what I was thinking, like a box set. But you know what I was also thinking, when I publish the fourth book, if I do publish it as an adult book, I would want to put the three original books together as sort of, you know, the coming of age of Annie or something like that. But I think I really have to talk to an agent. I really have to sit down with somebody who knows the business. And now, you know, I had like I guess you could call it a fire in the belly when I wrote the first, well, not when I wrote the first two books, but when I published them. You know, I wanted to get them out there. I worked on these three books furiously for the last 3 years. And now that I've got them out there and whatnot, I really feel like I could just kind of sit back and find an agent, you know, take the time, because it will take time and patience and certainly a thick skin to find somebody who believes in this project. And that we'll see what happens with that, because my original feeling was that I'm too old to subject myself to constant rejection, and I don't know if I have enough years left to finally get somebody who believes in this. But now I don't think that way. It's funny, you know, you evolve as you do something like this.
Linda, we are flat out of time, but
okay.
I do want to thank you very, very much for taking time to talk to us today. Do you have any parting words of wisdom?
My passing words of wisdom is that if you are thinking of writing a book or you have written a book, that you need to have discipline, but not drive yourself crazy. The biggest lesson I've learned in this is that I need to pace myself. Because if you don't pace yourself and you work at it constantly, you burn out. My other piece of advice is comb the internet. There's so much out there that can help you in a project of writing and marketing a book. And it can end up as a very exciting experience.
Linda, I really want to thank you. This is Simon Barrett, wishing everyone a happy, healthy, and safe week. We'll be back again soon with another edition of The Week in Reviews. Until then, goodbye.